You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, July 25th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Catherine Judge, professor at Columbia Law School, author of Direct, The Rise of the Middleman Economy and the Power of Going to the Source. Also on the program today, the Central Park Sixth, to be exonerated today after serving 30 years in prison. Housing market supposedly cools as Fed look to raise rates again this Wednesday. Steve Bannon found guilty on two counts of criminal contempt of Congress. Senate to move to fund semiconductor chip production subsidies. Trader Joe's raises pay by $10 an hour on Sundays on the eve of the union vote in Hadley, Mass. Go back and listen to our interview on June 21st, June 15th. For more on that, HarperCollins workers stage a one-day strike last week. In the latest Republican funded AIPAC money dump is now up to $3.3 million in primarying Andy Levin from Michigan. DOJ opens an environmental racism investigation in Houston. The FTC teeing up possible suit against the defense contractor Northrop Grumman for breach of its terms in its 2018 massive arms dealer merger. Producer merger. Russia strikes Odessa, threatening its deal to unblock Ukraine grain exports. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. Glad could be here. Little sweaty in the office again, of course.
Of course. It's part of its charm?
Yes.
Question mark?
We're waiting on a new air conditioner, but I don't know. We may have to get a newer air conditioner than the new one that we're waiting on. Emma Vigeland here, of course, as always. Just sweating to the newies.
Yeah, we will. We'll get a new air conditioner when hell freezes over, and by hell, I mean this office.
Yes. Well, it's a little more dramatic than I was going to go for. I thought we'll probably get it by October, but it could be. I mean, who knows? I don't have the dates on hell freezing over, so unclear in that accord. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I think people know it's a hot mostly around the country, very hot. I think Oregon's they're talking about maybe 110 degrees.
Jeez.
Today, Europe, of course, also sweltering. I wouldn't worry about it, folks.
Probably nothing.
Probably nothing.
Weather.
Probably nothing.
Just happens.
It happens.
Yeah.
There is, you know, I'm starting to see articles now written about folks in the Biden administration saying you're going to have to get a little unilateral of this because it's quite clear that nothing's happening with Joe Manchin. Right now they're racing to get reconciliation bill, which will give Medicare the ability to negotiate on drug prices. Unclear if it's all drug prices or specific drug prices. But also will extend the ACA subsidies that are due to run out in 2 months or so. And, I mean, the very, very bare minimum. And I don't know. Supposedly they have a deal to do this with Manchin, but can one really assume that's the case? I guess we'll find out.
Also, Manchin has COVID now. So, like, did you see that this morning?
No, I did not see that.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Well, I mean, I don't know if that affects this CHIPS legislation, but, I mean, hopefully he's not out for too long if they're trying to pass this stuff. But
we'll see. And they are this semiconductor chips subsidies to produce them in this country appear to be going through. They don't necessarily need Manchin's vote on this, I don't think. There seems to be a decent amount of bipartisan support on this. No worries about the inflationary effects of subsidizing the semiconductor chip business, which is not for me to say that it I have necessarily a problem with it, although I would like to own a piece of it if we're going to pay for it. But the argument about inflation is a little bit bunk. Maybe we'll talk to Professor Judge about that in a moment as well. Let's get to this. This is sort of fascinating. Not necessarily a huge amount of news here, although there conservatives gathered in some type of like, I mean, it's their Emmys, I guess. It is a Turning Points USA Action Conference. This is Charlie Kirk's outfit. And they got some big luminaries. One of them is Ted Cruz. And look at what they do here. It was requested we do this at the live show, but I don't have, you know, $75,000 to do an opening to make it seem like I'm interesting in some fashion.
Right.
And
like you're a wrestler or something like that,
or just some type of star. I mean, this is like you want to talk about the mindset of creating rock stars out of their politicians. I mean, you know, on the center to the left, there's a little bit of this. We do this, you know, on some level. There's too much, I think, sort of praising and focusing on individual politicians. But I mean, Ted Cruz, really?
Like they did, like the Democrats did this with Obama. They made him into a celebrity, but he has the charisma to warrant it to a degree. Ted Cruz is
Obama,
like
I don't even know that the Democrats
the blobfish
did like, the
that
country,
come alive.
The
yeah.
country did.
Yes,
they never needed something like this. This is bizarre. It's like for like literally for like 16-year-olds.
He has managed to unify the country. Everyone agrees he's doing a terrible job.
Oh, my God.
This looks spiral back.
It really is. This is just...
Hey, everybody.
It's me.
I've requested this for when I walk into the office, this kind of treatment.
Yeah, but that's because it's probably be nice and cool.
Wow!
All that mist.
Oh, God, the charisma.
He has
Brett Michaels.
Yeah, we don't need to see it again. That's good. Let's just see one of his top-line policy statements that he gets to during this. Honestly, it's like a conference set for, like, 16-year-old boys, I guess.
I know.
And frankly, I'm sorry to – I apologize to the 16-year-old boys out there for even saying that.
Yeah, I was into, like, Muse and Arctic Monkeys and, like, cool bands like Radiohead and stuff like that. And these kids are cheering to Ted Cruz.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
All of y'all on campuses across the country, your classmates, even if they're scared to say it, are looking around thinking this stuff is nuts.
Please clap.
I talked to a student recently at one of our woke college campuses who said she's required in every class to introduce herself and to give her pronouns.
Oh my God.
Well, I'm Ted Cruz and my pronoun is kiss my ass.
Yeah.
I mean,
God, what? It's like seeing the Beatles.
Do we really need to? We don't need to go any further on that. But let's listen to some of the policy proposals from Matt Gaetz. Here is one. I mean, it really is just This is what they're doing with their youth, folks. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. It is just so, there's something so twisted about this. I mean, were they booing at the fact that people had to introduce themselves, or they actually had to add their pronouns? Because that is really a bridge too far.
Oh, it's the pronouns. Oh, it's God. The pronouns.
I'm being facetious.
I'm really slow on the uptick today.
That's something you do on the first day of class. If there's any ambiguity, you clear it up. Yeah. Give people the opportunity. It's just crazy that they act so put upon about that
stuff. Oh, my gosh.
Well, and the funny part is that the other complaint they would have is like, I don't know what pronoun to use.
Right, exactly. It's so confusing.
It's so confusing. I don't know what pronoun to address this person with. Oh, and now I got to hear you tell us what your pronoun is? I mean, it's just, this is what they're running on, because the Dr. Seuss controversy blew over too quickly from a year ago. So it is just this sort of like Archie Bunker style, like, I don't know, silent generation, complaints that, like, it's so hard for me to tell how people are gender identifying, and also don't tell me how you're gender identifying.
When were comedians first doing that? I have to press one for English.
I mean, this was like 30 years ago. This stuff is so stale, but it's effective. Here's Matt Gaetz.
You watched these pro-abortion, pro-murder rallies? The people are just disgusting. Like, why is it that the women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions? Nobody wants to impregnate you if you look like a thumb. These people are odious on the inside and out. They're like 5'2", 350 pounds, and they're like, give me my abortions or I'll get up and march and protest. And I'm thinking, march? You look like you got ankles weaker than the legal reasoning behind Roe versus Wade. A few need to get up and march.
Do we really? I mean, honestly, like, this is, this is almost like Andrew Dice Clay level embarrassing.
Yeah. Is it Steven Crowder level comedy embarrassing?
This is their...
Somewhere between him and Dave Rubin.
One of the more popular congressmen in the Republican Party. And it is... I mean, he managed to stretch out. We're just misogynist. And he managed to make a whole bit about that.
Oh, yeah. He has opinions about which women are attractive or not, because mostly he's interested in girls and not women underage, allegedly.
I mean, nevertheless, like, can you imagine a congressperson getting up and making like this is the Republican Party?
Oh yeah, Matt Gaetz comes from a political family. His dad was a politician, also got in trouble for some Medicare fraud, his business did, and his I think grandfather was a North Dakota politician. This is Republicans.
Exactly. This is their... We do misogyny, but we try and make it a little bit amusing. Really stunning. But there it is. That's what the kids are doing these days at the Turning Points USA, or like, you know, the...
Student Action Summit.
Student Action Summit.
Oh, great.
Sign up, folks. We've got a workshop this afternoon on misogyny, one on homophobia, and one on transphobia. And then we're going to do those. We're just going to keep running the same three over and over again so you can get some policy points on that. All right, we're going to take a quick break in just a moment, and we'll be welcoming Catherine Judge, professor at Columbia Law School, author of Direct, The Rise of Middleman Economy and the Power of Going to the Source. But first, a couple words from our sponsors today. One out of three Americans report being sleep deprived. That's generally me. And part of that reason could be their sheets. That could be part of the problem. Not so much for me. For me, it's just like, I don't know, head. Like, I spend too much time making lists in my head.
Yes.
At any time. But Cozy Earth, which are my sheets of choice, provide the softest, most luxurious, and here's the key. Well, for me anyways. Like, I'm not too big on the soft or luxurious.
Mm-hmm.
I like it, but I could, if I had temperature control, I could sleep on just on the floor. They are temperature regulating sheets. Rather important right now.
Yes.
My air conditioning is not doing it.
Yeah.
Cozy Earth has been featured on Oprah's Most Favorite Things list 4 years in a row. They're made from super soft viscose. It's from bamboo. Cozy Earth sheets breathe so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all year round. They have thousands of five-star reviews. They have become the bedding of choice for interior designers and celebrities.
Like myself.
Like Emma, who has a duvet.
I do.
Cozy Earth even offers a 100-night sleep trial, which means you have up to 100 nights to sleep on it. You wash it, try it out. If you're not completely in love with your sheets, you send it back for a full refund. It's a no-lose proposition, folks. There's a 10-year warranty. Cozy Earth sheets come in four new colors. Again, it's the temperature control. The softness is great. The luxuriousness is great. But for me, it's the temperature control.
Mm.
I need temperature control. I get too hot. Some sheets just like it's like you're in like a insulated, one of those like a...
It's like they're trying to keep you warm.
Exactly.
Right.
For a limited time, you save 35% on Cozy Earth bedding. Go to CozyEarth.com/majority. Enter my special promo code majority at checkout to save 35% now. That's CozyEarth.com/majority. Be sure to enter majority at checkout for 35% off. Okay. Next up, one more sponsor. True story. Last night, I was contemplating going over to my buddy's house. Finally, more or less disposed with the children. I haven't done anything wrong to them, I should say.
Sam has disposed of his children.
And to go over and have a drink. And then I realized, like, I'm out of my Z-biotics.
Oh.
And I'm like, I don't want to be a wreck tomorrow. It's just going to be too hot. And the last thing I need is a headache. So I've got to get more. What is Z-Biotics? It is a probiotic drink that breaks down the byproduct of alcohol, which surprise to me is why you feel horrible the next morning. It's not the dehydration. It's like a chemical that comes out of your gut, essentially. You drink a bottle of Z-Biotics before your first drink of alcohol. It's a little bottle like this big, tiny. One bottle is all you need for the night. Doesn't matter if you're going to have one drink or multiple ones. You drink responsibly. You pace yourself. Get a good night's sleep. The next day, you feel great. You're not going to feel like, oh, I don't feel too sick to work out. Why did I do this to myself last night? I can't drink again. I can't ever have another drink. You drink, this toxic byproduct of alcohol builds up in your gut, and you feel crappy the next day. Well, Z-Biotics produces an enzyme, more or less like the one that your liver uses. It breaks down this byproduct. Z-Biotics is the first genetically engineered probiotic. It's created by altering the DNA of a natural probiotic bacteria that we eat all the time. Z-Biotics is not vitamins or plant extracts. There's no off-the-shelf ingredients. Z-Biotics has been rigorously tested and is FDA compliant for safety. If you're the kind of person who likes to drink with friends, unwind at the end of the day, still have a full day planned the next day, Z-Biotics is perfect for you. Doesn't matter whether you want your tomorrow to be a productive one or a relaxing one, you don't want to feel bad. Get 15% off your first order of Z-Biotics pre-alcohol probiotic. Go to zbiotics.com/majority. Use the code MAJORITY. That's the letter Z, B-I-O-T-I-C-S, zbiotics.com/majority. Coupon code MAJORITY at checkout saves you 15%. The link is in the description. Okay, we need to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll be talking to Catherine Judge on her book, Direct, The Rise of the Middleman Economy and the Power of Going to the Source. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland, on the Majority Report. I want to welcome to the program Catherine Judge. She's a professor at Columbia Law School, author of Direct, The Rise of the Middleman Economy and the Power of Going to the Source. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's let's just start. Like, what is the middleman economy in your words? And then I want to also get a sense of, like, when did this develop?
Yeah. So two great questions. The middleman economy, which is important to distinguish from middlemen, is really the combination of these really large middlemen, Amazon and Walmart in retail. You can think of JP Morgan or Citi in banking. And then as they grew in size, we got longer and more complex supply chains. So the middleman economy is the combination of these really outsized middlemen and the long chains through which goods and money now flows. And in terms of timing, it really has been over the last 40 to 50 years. And part of what was striking and motivated me in the book is I saw this first in banking, which is where most of my work has been, a shift from community banking, where you had small institutions that were really grounded in a neighborhood based on relationships, to the growth of these large institutions that use data and then really created an international system. And I saw the exact same thing happening in food, in retail, in domain after domain.
Let's start with banking and just walk us through this, because you attribute what happened in 2008 in terms of the financial crisis in large part to this sort of dynamic that exists there. And I think people don't generally contemplate finance when they think about supply chains. But there's a lot of, like, I guess what I've been describing for years as side bets, which, just from having played poker with friends, you know, anybody who drops out is all of a sudden wants still a piece of the action, because many of them had problems, and they would do a side bet. But will you walk us through this concept within the context of banking? And if you could also highlight when there were certain statutory changes, and I'm thinking about Glass-Steagall for the most part, that fundamentally altered this dynamic.
Yeah. And so it's actually interesting for the statutory changes. Glass-Steagall is a huge part of it. The removal of the Glass-Steagall wall, also real legal. And so I'll get there in a second. So traditionally in the United States, we had a system of unit banking, which means we really limited the ability of banks to grow geographically. And so we had small banks that were scattered across the country. At the height, we had about 16,000 different types of different bank and thrift organizations. Sometimes they had local branches, but they generally constrained to a state, and oftentimes really operating out of an area that was small within that state. And we can go back and look at the way that they banked. And we can see that they were willing to take risks, for example, on small businesses, making loans that were not economical, because they expected to get that business from the small business if it grew and it was successful. So they were really grounded in relationships. They were really grounded in their community. They were taking money from local depositors and cycling it back into the community. And there were some fragility problems with this, but there were also some advantages. So there were some significant trade-offs. And then we really had multiple decades of deregulation. And so we did allow the merging of investment banking and commercial banking, which I think is the most famous. But we also really lifted a lot of the geographical restrictions that had previously existed. And banking regulators became more willing to allow mergers to go forward. Mm. And so what we saw is a small number of institutions, really the top 4 to 6 banks, depending on how you look at it, grew and took over a bigger and bigger proportion of the outstanding banking assets. And in the process, they had a different way of doing banking. So what they would do is they would use a lot of data, and they would create these standardized metrics to figure out whether or not they should make a loan. And this made it a lot easier for them to not only hold those loans on their balance sheet, but to put them into securitization vehicles, where they suddenly could create this new entity and say, look, we've done a bunch of research. Here's a bunch of representations and warranties over why this portfolio is going to perform. And then that's how you started to get things that looked like supply chains or capital supply chains. But you had money flowing in from Europe and Asia, where you had loans layered into securitization vehicles and sometimes other layers after that, whether it's asset-backed commercial paper or layered securitization entities, which allowed all kinds of new money to flow into home loans and to other types of loans, but also created a lot of new sources of fragility and undermined accountability in some meaningful ways.
So we had two different dynamics, if I hear you correctly on this. One is the ability for these banks essentially to get larger, and there was multiple ways in which they did it on different planes, both in terms of like what type of businesses they could engage in and the geographical limitations they had. So we allowed these banks to get larger. The way their business changed was from personal relationships, which the fragility you speak of was like, well, If Jenny's lumber company goes under, we've invested a lot in that in terms of a loan, and she can't pay back this loan. We're in trouble. But at the same time, we have a relationship with Jenny. We're going to place localized bets that aren't necessarily the best odds necessarily, but they're all that are offered to us. So we're going to take those if we want to engage in business, and we'll be conservative in other areas. Whereas once they get bigger, we forget about Jenny and we just look at the sheer volume, and we're just going to place 30 bets out of the 1,000 that we could. And we know that statistically those 30 should, 15 of those should pay off and pay for the whole suite essentially for everything.
Yeah. And that's it. And they hoped it was like higher than 15 out of 30, but that was certainly it. It became much more of a numbers game, and partly data and the incredible money that they could put into developing fancy models and into really high tech, IT allowed them to increase the accuracy of those bets. But as we've seen, once you try to shift away and align the importance of person and place and in the individual characteristics, there's a lot that you lose that turns out to really matter in certain states of the world.
And that's what happens when these things get securitized. Essentially, you have an anonymous group of loans that are given some quality standard, in which we had a problem with that with the rating agencies too. And people are just like, okay, it's rated AAA, so I'm gonna bet on this, and then the whole house cards falls apart. So how does this also apply to let's say retail? I mean, I get a sense in terms of Amazon, less so with Walmart, explain this to us in terms of retail.
Yeah. So first of all, just to follow up on your example a little bit, part of the reason everything exploded is that actually the number of home loans that went bad was significant, but it wasn't overwhelming, and it shouldn't have overwhelmed the financial system. A core challenge is those chains were so complex that once people didn't rely and didn't trust the ratings, then suddenly you were in a situation where people had to instead find out for themselves what they'd be worth, and they couldn't do that in a timely way. So market participants didn't know, and regulators didn't know, and that exacerbated the fragility. And that's where we are right now with supply chains. So in different but similar ways, and I do think this applies to Amazon and not just Walmart, even though the mechanisms are different, you see this incredible scale, right? You have these middlemen that are suddenly feeding so many more consumers that they want things on a whole different scale. And at that scale, it seems efficient if what you're trying to do is minimize price, to kind of disaggregate the process of production, because every little bit of cost savings that you can get from doing this step and wherever it's cheapest to do that step seems worth it at that level of scale. So we see the growth of the size of these middlemen. And then we see a change in production from being something that not only happens in the U.S. to something that happens abroad, to then being actually a multi-continent undertaking where different pieces are carried out at different places along the way. And that works really well when everybody trusts the system to work, just like it works really well when everybody trusts ratings. The problem, which we've been experiencing for a year now, is once that system starts to break down, rather than engaging in self-correction, the dysfunction creates further dysfunction and the fragility builds on itself. So there's a lack of resilience that is costly not only to the players, but to the rest of the economy and society.
But does it work really well at the even in its initial orientation? Because the dynamic of these middlemen, particularly with supply chains, is that it drives up prices unnecessarily when you don't have that efficiency. It seems to me that it creates a higher burden on the consumer than is really necessary, all while it allows for everyone else involved to get richer.
Yeah, so there's certainly significant costs along the way, and it depends on, this is where the setting matters quite a bit. One, we do see that all of the attributes that make the large middlemen so good at their jobs also give them outsized power. So they contort the evolution of the market, and they also contort the rules that are governing their activity, right, in ways that do allow for excess concentration, and that has harms. The other real challenge is, as these chains become more complex and the middlemen become so powerful, there's a lack of information. And that goes to your point about the burden on a consumer. If all you care about is kind of the highest risk-adjusted return or the cheapest price relative to the good you're receiving, the system might seem like it works all right. But if you actually care about whether there's child labor involved or the environmental impact, then suddenly the burden on you becomes extreme and the ability to hide things also becomes extreme.
And of course, we also get the type of we have the fragility of the supply lines that we're seeing now. And I want to circle back to this in a bit, because they're just about to pass this chips bill, the semiconductor chips bill, which ostensibly is addressing at least a very specific element. But semiconductor chips in our today's society obviously have. Implications in a lot of different industries. But how is what we're talking about now different from an antitrust issue? Because we have this aggregate, and so much of this is a function of size, it seems to me, that size both engenders the problem, because it also provides it creates a different sort of structure in which people can do business. The bigger banks all of a sudden just rely on data. The bigger retailers, have a certain monopsony, and so they can sort of dictate terms to their sources and suppliers. How is this not exclusively an antitrust issue?
So it is an antitrust issue, but it's more than an antitrust issue. So first of all, one of the takeaways clearly is we need to do a better job with antitrust enforcement. And a lot of these domains, the problem has grown to be bigger than it ever ought to have been allowed to become, because a lot of this does overlap with the classic harms that competition policy is meant to address, which are the dangers that flow from that excessive concentration. And kind of there's been a renewed interest and renewed appreciation of the variety and depth of those costs. So part of this is, yes, we need to be doing a better job enforcing antitrust law, and we need to do so particularly when what we're talking about are intermediaries or middlemen, because the harms there are significant. It goes beyond antitrust, though, in a couple of different ways. One, antitrust traditionally has not been focused on the fragility dynamics. That's something we focus a lot on banking and financial regulation, but we haven't normally thought about resilience as something that we need to prioritize and think about in a structural way in domains beyond banking, beyond some kind of certain critical domains that we recognize as critical. And I would say right now we're at an inflection point where we recognize that building in resilience is going to require a broader set of tools, both by companies and by regulators, and that has benefits that overlap but are certainly not synonymous with what you would think about with antitrust. It could arise in other areas. And the other thing I'd say, there's additional solutions of what we can try to do here. So a lot of what antitrust is about is top-down solutions. It's trying to limit these concentrations of power. But once we start to understand the structure of the middleman economy, then we realize that another way of trying to balance out the playing field can be creating the infrastructure that we need to build resilience, but also competitiveness and an outside option from the bottom up. So whether that's a post office, whether it's kind of, subsidized reshoring of particular activities, it allows for a broader thinking about the types of interventions that we need to achieve the outcomes that we want to achieve.
Okay, so let's just start. I want to sort of unwind some of that there. By resilience, like what do you mean by resilience in this instance?
Yeah, so resilience is in the face of a shock, and it can be an endogenously created shock, where 2008, the banks had made overly risky loans, and so they created a shock that then reverberated and broke down the system. Or it could be exogenous. I mean, the pandemic was an exogenous shock relative to supply chains. So resilience is, in the face of a shock to a system, how well is that system able to keep functioning? How well is it able to keep provisioning critical goods? And so in banking, that's about, like, are you able to keep making loans? Are you able to keep accepting deposits? Are you able to keep providing liquidity? In the real economy, it's about PPE early on in the pandemic. Like one was just there was a shift in demand relative to supply. But a second is a lot of our sources were in Asia, and we suddenly couldn't access those sources. So how is it, even if we have to pay a little more in good times, can we ensure that we have at least a consistent access to this good in good times and bad times? We're seeing that right now with baby formula. I think the semiconductor is a part of that. It's like, how can we make sure, even if we don't reshore all of production, that we have an adequate domestic capability or capability in friendlier nations and in closer geographic areas, such that when there's a shock to the system, whether that's invasion of Ukraine, whether it's a pandemic, or whether it's a huge shock to housing prices, how well can the system continue to function and provide the services and goods that we need?
Okay, and so the limitations on antitrust is that it is more, I guess, reactionary on some level to attempts to consolidate. Although I guess we could unwind things and bring things back. I mean, for what it's worth, it's happening with Northrop Grumman, maybe with the FTC. But that you argue that we need to sort of create a new infrastructure for which we deliver these goods and services, I guess, from the bottom up. Like what – when you say we, are we talking about our government doing this through like some type of industrial planning or what comes of it? I mean, because we're seeing it with this – with the semiconductor thing. On some level, it's also sort of like, okay, well, we're providing subsidies, and I guess the benefit is that we're not going to have a scarcity of cars going forward, theoretically, because they need semiconductor chips and they can't get them from wherever it is they're buying in Asia because, you know, there's a lockdown or something. I guess that is also the benefit. I also sort of inclined to think, like, I'd like a little piece of what I'm investing in terms of cash. But or ownership or equity. But is that what we're talking about? Walk us through what that means to do it from bottom up.
Yeah. So first of all, I mean, both in terms of who's doing it, I think it's both the government. It is kind of individuals can make different decisions, but really it's government. It's also companies starting to make different decisions. You know, I mean, I think it's always noisy when the government does a lot of reforms, how much private shift there is. But we're already seeing companies making very different decisions in terms of their supply chains, both in terms of at times diversifying sources, but also deepening relationships, trying to limit some of the excess complexity, because I think they have been more focused on those short-term cost savings than their ability to access goods over the cycle. And for car companies, which you referenced, I mean, not only was it a contributor to the inflation, which has really harmed all of us, but it was harmful to those companies. I mean, they lost out on an incredible volume of sales in 2021. So not only car companies, but other industries are looking at that and starting to realize, oh, well, maybe to be able to maximize kind of our long-term profitability, we actually need to make different decisions. Nonetheless, the level of investment you're going to get on a purely private basis is probably always going to be insufficient relative to the public goods that we want. So part of it is a private correction, and then it is a public correction. And again, that varies
by the private correction, and just to be clear, the private correction is going to be focused on the specific problems of individual entities as opposed to a system-wide situation, right? I mean, on some level, it's in the best interest of these individual entities to figure out a solution that their competitors don't. And so, you know, having it be system-wide is sort of runs contrary to their best interests on some level, unless they are the system, right? I mean, for the most part.
Yeah. No, I think that's certainly accurate. And that's where the government is going to have a critical role to play. I think at times it's not always one or the other. There are times, particularly when we think about an international playing field as opposed to a domestic playing field, that some coordination can bring collective benefits where it's worth the investment. And so we see a lot of that kind of around data and data sharing and some of the information sharing. But it's clearly the private solution is going to get us to a better but suboptimal place relative to where we really want to be at, particularly when we're talking about critical goods. And then the public setting, I mean, so like you said, I mean, I do think that things like this, you know, efforts to onshore some semiconductor capabilities in this vein, I would say also like as basic as like rethinking the investments we want to make in the post office. I mean, a lot of the question is once we have this middleman economy, once we recognize how it's going to perpetuate itself, provide some benefits, but also introduce new risks, part of it is creating a structure that allows people to opt out. So just as simple as Amazon, you know, like people like Amazon because there's a really easy website to use. It's got a zillion options and you have all these user reviews, but it also has an incredible fulfillment system. And, you know, most Americans are Prime members at this point, which is actually unbelievable, but true. So then you're in a situation where people are feel like it's free to get a good kind of the same day or the next day. And there's always going to be a cost when they opt out. But the question is, how big is that cost going to be? And so, for example, by making significant additional investments, and already we're trying to revamp the post office system, but trying to make it not so it like manages to make money, but instead trying to make it so it actually provides the infrastructure. So if you want to go to a smaller maker or a smaller creator, you're not having to wait 5 days as opposed to one, maybe it's like three. And the cost of that is a little bit less burdensome, then those two can again help to create a more level playing field.
What other areas? So we could, so one option is to invest in the post office, or at least, and there's been a fix, I think, in terms of the 75 year health pension requirements, but to genuinely sort of upgrade the post office service, ostensibly maybe with some capital investment, maybe just some operating money, because the post office runs primarily just by on the sale of stamps, so that they could provide a service that would help smaller businesses compete. What are other sort of infrastructure, I guess, and this is sort of like the positive investments as opposed to the regulatory sort of like tamping down on growth from an antitrust perspective. What are the other investments that our government could make that would reorient the our economy in this way?
Yeah, so a lot of it can also be done at the state and local level, right? And there already actually is a lot that's being done at the state and local level, because that's where a lot of the information and the responsiveness is. But it's how do you, for example, even just creating settings, you know, like farmers markets have actually increased at a very significant rate for almost three decades now. And that's possible because cities make public spaces available for those farmers markets to occur. And that might seem like a small decision, but it requires a lot of effort, requires some investment, some figuring out the logistics, but it makes a very significant difference. So now people still go to grocery stores. It's not that people who shop at farmers markets don't also go to grocery stores, but in choosing to be able to opt and get even a little bit of their food more directly from the farmer, where it's either the farmer or kind of somebody on their behalf, where there's a much shorter chain, there's more information, there's more accountability, and there's actually spillover effects in terms of how people eat and other aspects of their diet. So there's a lot that you can do in terms of kind of creating the spaces for a connection.
And it seems there's a third element that is necessary too. I mean, with antitrust and these sort of various sort of positive initiatives, and that is, you know, the idea that it's going to be a little bit more expensive to do all this, but ultimately going to provide for a better societal good. What do we do about the fact that we have people who can't afford to shop at a farmer's market, and that, you know, farmer's markets are generally situated, for the most part, not totally, either, you know, extremely rural areas where it's not, that, or in cities where there is a higher concentration of wealth, specific areas of that city, because, you know, it's more expensive. Like, what do we do on that end to make all this work?
Yeah. So, I mean, farmers market, just to build on that example for a second, one of the things that we're already doing very often is oftentimes you are able to use SNAP benefits at a farmers market. And that does, and there's been specific research looking at people who are using various types of government subsidized programs, and there are positive beneficial effects on their overall eating when they're making those decisions. So it's expanding not just the ability to use those types of benefits, but really kind of advertising it away so there's greater awareness that makes it a real option. More generally, part of what's interesting is we tend to think about consumers or investors in our status as consumers or investors, right? And part of what I try to draw out indirect is that is a segmenting off of the different parts of who we are in ways that have really been destructive to a lot of what has traditionally been the kind of the backbone of the economy and the way that feeds into society. And so part of what's been interesting to me as I've written this book, a lot of people living in cities, when I talk about more direct exchange and shorter supply chains, they're like, oh, you know, you're talking about these like boutique little places in Brooklyn or Silver Lake and these like high-end areas. But actually, I've gotten incredible responses from people in Ohio and South Carolina asking me to come talk because they already see this happening in their communities, because it's the way a lot of people are already making money on the side. There's already actually a lot of very small business. And actually, over the last couple of years, we've seen a record number of small business starts, which has been really interesting to see. And so part of what's interesting is that it is actually already happening, not as a complete displacement, but as a little bit of a counterbalance, where people are finding ways to take kind of what had been hobbies and make them profitable. And oftentimes the only way to do so is when they are not paying incredible fees to middlemen, but they're finding ways to harness and connect to people in their communities, or using kind of online websites that make it relatively low cost for them to sell their goods directly, rather than trying to kind of fight in a highly intermediated system for visibility.
I mean, this was the promise of the internet, wasn't it? To essentially eliminate the need for brokers, I mean, more or less. And let's just talk also in terms of real estate, because we have a housing crisis in this country, I think, in many respects, as a function of the 2008 financial crisis. I don't know that we ever, you know, we lost several years of building houses because of that crisis. And now I think we're feeling it, and rents, sales have softened now, but rents are still sky high. Does your paradigm or assessment of this paradigm involve real estate at all? And how do we address is it a middleman question, or is it simply a supply question in the context of real estate?
Both. So on your point about the internet, it's key, because originally we did see Bill Gates and these other internet enthusiasts saying, look, this is going to get rid of all middlemen. And instead, we've seen just the opposite. It's actually fed the creation of middlemen that are even larger and even more powerful, and whose power just keep growing, right? And so we are seeing that with Amazon and other spaces, but we are also seeing Etsy and Shopify and these alternative spaces start to arise. That do allow kind of an alternative ecosystem. So it's not just an alternative way of getting the good, but you need to kind of the fulfillment on all the different pieces. But what we're seeing with the internet is it's led to both. And so it's not that the technology alone could be harnessed either to make the powerful players more powerful, or it is also starting to be harnessed at the times in trying to create these smaller areas. For real estate, I'd say it's a bit of both. So one, there's just an underlying supply problem where, again, after 2008, we had housing starts that were too low. And I'd been at conferences with housing experts in late 2019, and they said, we have too few homes. And it took a while for everybody else to wake up to that fact. But that was a problem that had been building for a very long time. That being said, one of the ways this problem really rises in real estate is in real estate agents. So when I talk about there being too many middlemen, sometimes that's kind of like Amazon and this whole long supply chains. In real estate, it becomes manifest in the fact that in the United States, for most real estate transactions, we still have a full-service buyer's agent and a full-service seller's agent, and they're still charging between them 5% of the value of the home sold. And that's twice what you're typically paying in the UK, in Canada, in Australia. And again, it goes back to your point about the internet. So the internet made it a lot cheaper in all of those places, because particularly if you're on the buy side, it's a lot easier to go online, figure out the homes you want to see, and kind of arrange for showings. But in the United States, even when you're looking at Zillow or Redfin, you're really using a database, the multiple listing service, that was created and continues to be controlled by full-service real estate agents. And so what we see is that there's a whole variety of different mechanisms that they've worked hard to entrench the current system where it feels free for a buyer, but the net effect is, you know, real estate is the number one financial asset for your average middle-class family. In contrast to the rich who own stocks and bonds, for your middle-class family, the house is their biggest, most valuable financial asset. And we are making it significantly more costly than it ought to be for people to tap into that asset because of the way real estate agents have really entrenched a system that, again, I think was incredibly valuable in the 1970s and 80s, but that has outlived its usefulness.
Well, it's entrenched the system not just when you're purchasing a home. It's also entrenched the system when you're looking for a rental, which is a completely redundant and unnecessary, in the bad way, an unnecessary fee that's associated, particularly here in New York, where they're also supposed to be outlawed, but they still happen. So, I mean, can you talk about that in the rental market, not just in the real estate purchasing market?
You can certainly talk about it. So it's a huge problem in the rental market. And again, it's a combination of factors where they make themselves useful and they get entrenched initially. But what's interesting is there have been efforts to outlaw them, but that various times there's often like legal efforts to protect their ability to provide these services, even though they're incredibly costly. And kind of going back to the earlier conversation over what lawmakers can do, one of the biggest things they can do is just stop adopting laws that protect middlemen. And part of what I show in direct is in domain after domain. We're seeing it right now with electric car sales are behind where they should be because, you know, car dealerships as the middlemen have played a great job shaping rules. Same with the real estate, they have rules that protect them. In like exchanging trucks, they've had rules that protect them. So what we'll see is when they gain control, they also contort rules to protect their use. So part of it is just trying to figure out like, let's get rid of the rules that purport to be protecting consumers, but really are protecting middlemen. And then let's try to figure out kind of where are the ways we can create a better outcome. And it is challenging.
Well, that mechanism in which to inhibit and mitigate the power of these associations, right? I mean, the car dealers, let's say, for instance, like that seems to me to be an FTC or an antitrust type of this where we need regulations, right? We need to break up these cartels so that not only are they not anti-competitive within the context of the consumer market, but they're not anti-democratic in the sense that they have an outsized power in influencing our lawmakers.
And that's exactly it. And part of what's interesting is antitrust enforcers have recognized this for a long period of time. And at times they've even appeared to make progress, but then they'll enter consent decrees that don't bring about the changes they're supposed to. So in real estate, a lot of the anti-competitive practices by the National Association of Realtors, which is the big interest group on their behalf, have been the subject of numerous lawsuits. And we finally saw in a 2008 agreement between the Department of Justice and the NAR that says, look, we're really going to try and change things. We're going to make all these changes that allow for a more competitive landscape. And yet here we are 14 years later. And actually even a decade afterwards, the FTC and the DOJ had a big conference to say like, okay, like how much innovation have we managed to inspire? How much change has there been? And the reality was you had an incredible number of incumbents who'd or new players that offered seemingly better services that seemed poised to disrupt the market. And yet, one after one, they either quashed or were failed. And so part of what we need to understand is that it's not only we have to bring these tools to bear, but we do have to understand in very specific and context-sensitive ways, what are the various attributes, the control over infrastructure, the relationships that give middlemen the outsized power, because it's only by understanding what makes them distinctly harmful that we can craft the type of policy solutions that are actually going to be effective and help us achieve better outcomes longer term.
So much of this seems incumbent upon returning to a pre, and to some extent we're starting to do that with this administration. One of the, in my estimation, one of the highlights of this administration is at least a move to return to a pre-Robert Bork sense of what constitutes antitrust, and that it's not just a measure of, you know, short-term cheaper prices for the consumer, but long-term, these questions of resiliency, these questions of market power, these questions of impact on our democracy, you know, so that we can efficiently address these problems. I mean, that's ultimately what we're saying. When we have a loss of democracies, we can't really address these problems because there's outsized interests that are making money off of the sort of market failures, if you will, or the inequality that exists currently.
And I think that hopefully will be one of the long-term legacies of this administration. And it takes time to bring about meaningful change. You know, we've had a very long period of time where we've had a very narrow paradigm of the type of harms that were cognizable for antitrust purposes, and a very narrow sense of the type of tools that we ought to be using to promote competition. And I think we've seen a variety of signs from this administration and through the leaders that they've chosen, that they are really working to bring back a more robust understanding of what they're supposed to achieve and how they're supposed to achieve it. And I think it's going to take time, but it has been an absolutely critical shift.
Isn't, this is a bit of a left turn, I guess, but aren't health insurance companies the ultimate middleman? Talking a bit more radically here, but private health insurance is a price gouging enterprise, essentially, and it would be a lot more efficient for everybody if it just came directly from the government.
So I could not agree more that everybody knows that we'd have a much better system if we had a single payer system. And so there's a lot to look at that's wrong with healthcare. Healthcare is also an area where even beyond the health insurers, the incentives that arise and the opacity that arises because of how we pay for healthcare is an area where we also see a growing number of middlemen. And this is one of the current priorities where we've seen not just Chair Lina Khan, but all five FTC commissioners actually sign on to a recent effort to look in the practices of pharmacy benefit managers, for example, which are one of the... And so we oftentimes talk about the middlemen we see, and I talk about those because those are the ones that are most visible to us. But very often, it's the wholesalers and distributors that are right behind the actors that you see where a lot of the power really accrues. And there's some really interesting research looking in areas like insulin, for example, where even as the cost is going up, the amount that's actually going to the producers has been going down. It's instead the pharmacies and the PBMs, the middlemen in the space, who are seeing their profits rise.
And we should say there's like, what, four or five PBMs, right? Like McKesson, CVS, I don't even know the other two.
Or Walgreens? No,
I think it's I don't know who the other two or three are.
There's a very small number that control an incredible proportion of the market, which is precisely why this is another classic example.
And they're getting kickbacks from both ends, right? I mean, I think we recently spoke to, I think was it Matt Stoller that we spoke to about this? I can't remember, but these PBMs are highly problematic, it seems to me, in terms of the. So with that said, do you think that negotiations with Medicare, which is, drug negotiations via Medicare, which may happen under reconciliation, according to Joe Manchin's, you know, tea leaves today. And also, can you give an assessment of that if you think that will impact the way the PBMs operate? in some fashion, and also give us an assessment of the semiconductor bill that looks like it's going to pass in the Senate within a number of days. I think they're voting on cloture today. Give me your assessment of both of those sort of changes, which I presume you would perceive as not so much the antitrust area, but on the other sort of like build the infrastructure area.
Yeah. So I think, first of all, both of those is absolutely critical. I mean, neither of them are going to kind of transform the entire area, but they are precisely the types of moves that we ought to be making. In terms of negotiation, it is a meaningful benefit. But going back to our conversation about real estate and the previous efforts to bring about enforcement change, it's not just do you have the power to negotiate, but how informed are you about the structural issues that cause these problems to grow on themselves? And how willing are you to go in and negotiate not just with respect to price, but potentially also with respect to structure in ways that help to address some of the incentive problems that arise? Because part of the problem is if you have too many middlemen and they're all trying to get a little bit of a cut, even if you can negotiate, what you're going to get is going to be set by a baseline that just assumes too many people taking too much relative to what would be optimal. So it's both the ability to negotiate, but it's also the ability to use that wisely and strategically to really make sure that you're getting the long-term gains and with an eye towards the broader system so that there should be positive effects outside of the Medicare domain because you're actually trying to thoughtfully bring about structural changes needed. Same thing for the semiconductors. I think part of what we're seeing there is an understanding that for geopolitical reasons, if nothing else, intermediation really matters. Middleman structure really matters. Where things are made really matters. You know, we had this period of globalization where we tried to pretend all these things didn't matter and that all we wanted was an efficient system. And instead we got a system that was fragile and controlled by a geopolitical party that we ought to be really concerned about. And so I think it's a helpful effort to say not only where things are made, but again, that's going to be helpful in thinking strategically about, well, what are the mechanisms through which these new onshore goods are going to be distributed? And kind of how do we help to build resilience, not just at the level of the production of the semiconductor, but in the relationships between that semiconductor producer and other important American companies?
Let me also, one last question, sorry. I couldn't help myself. In terms of inflation, the Fed supposedly is going to raise interest rates again on Wednesday. The rumor, I guess, is 0.75 again. Give me your sense of just the inflation that we're experiencing. It is real insofar as it costs more for, you know, me to buy milk. It costs more for me to buy bread. It costs more for me to buy lumber or gas. And it certainly has been far more durable, this inflationary period, than I had presumed it would be a year or two ago. The theory that we hear from at least the Washington, D.C., and by some, is that we've spent too much money and we have created too much demand for our economy to fulfill. But Britain has almost the exact same inflation rate. There's a disparity between the cost of oil by barrel and gas that is out of whack with what we've seen in the past. I mean, how much of this inflation, and I don't mean real insofar as it's experienced, but how much of this inflation is driven by the dynamic that we're told there's too much demand relative to our production, I guess, capacity as opposed to ability, right? Because like, there isn't all of a sudden overnight, all of a sudden, like everybody's just got much more demand associated. It's just, it's changed a little bit as to what people want. And, you know, we still had total lockdowns in major production centers in China, like as of, I don't know, 6 weeks ago, maybe less. How much of what the Fed is doing is really about inhibiting what's happening in the labor market versus what's happening of these inflationary pressures?
Yes, I think it's key to step back and to think not only about the choices the Fed is making now, and yes, it looks like 75 basis points, they feel like they're behind the curve, they need to feel like they feel the need to ramp up quickly, but how we got here. One, I would say we had artificially low prices for an extended period of time because the prices were enabled by these inherently fragile supply chains. And building an adequate amount of resilience is going to increase price levels some. That doesn't mean a loop of ongoing inflation, but that price levels should even out at something higher than what we saw previously because they were artificially depressed because of the fragility that is built in the system. It's the same thing we've seen in credit creation, right? Credit creation is plentiful today, but slightly less so than it was pre-2007 and 8 and Dodd-Frank because we decided we needed to invest in a more resilient system, and I think we need to do the same for the rest of the economy. But part of what is really interesting here is not just, as you said, the overall supply versus demand, but the Fed was also really slow to realize that the supply chain problems that started to become manifest really in 2021 were going to be persistent and grow before they corrected themselves. And that is incredibly reminiscent of where we started the show, which was talking about 2007 and 2008. What we saw there is the crisis started in August 2007 when there was just no liquidity in subprime mortgage-backed securities. And there was 13 months of the Fed just injecting a little more liquidity here, injecting a little more liquidity there, and assuming that the problem was going to correct themselves. But you had these incredible securitization chains that meant risk was spread everywhere in ways the Fed couldn't see and the way market participants couldn't see. And there was an assumption that it would self-correct. And it didn't. It exploded. The dysfunction created more dysfunction. And I'd say we've seen the same thing with supply chains over the past year. We saw the team transitory, if you want to call it that or not, was really based on this idea that so long as we're patient, if it's just supply chain problems, they're going to wreck themselves. And eventually they will. But the supply chains had created such a complex ecosystem reminiscent of securitization chains that the dysfunction beget a lot more dysfunction before it corrected themselves. So I think that contributed. It was not the only factor, but it contributed to the Fed being slow in coming in right now. So I agree with you, first of all, your bigger point, which is just the types of problems we're facing right now require policymakers to do more than the Fed is able to do. And the tools that the Fed is bringing to the table are not sufficient as the set of tools that we need to deal with the price dynamics we're facing. But I also think there's more direct lessons from the importance of understanding intermediation and kind of some of the broader lessons indirect and the problems we're facing right now.
But I mean, but wasn't the other problem that the Fed had in making this assessment, and I'm still not necessarily convinced that the Fed needs to react in this way, because I think it's not only not a blunt, not only like a sort of like a precision. It's not only a blunt tool, it's also even more imprecise in terms of where how it impacts the economy, right? Because its first thing is housing, and that's sort of almost the last thing that we need it to be doing, it seems to me, when it deals with interest rates. But the other factor, too, was, you know, nobody could predict what COVID was doing, and nobody would predict the political response to the virus, because, you know, in New York, we have more people in hospital today than we did this time last year, and nobody's talking about it. And that's a political reaction to COVID, which, you know, nobody knew if people were. I mean, I look at a restaurant and just, you fired all of your wait staff because people weren't coming in. You went down to a skeleton crew because you're just doing takeout. And then on some Friday night, all of a sudden, everybody shows up to come in and eat, and you don't have a wait staff. And you don't have as much food. And so you just say, well, there's a half a dozen people who are willing to pay three times, you know, twice the amount for a hamburger. And I'm going to raise the prices. And maybe I'm making actually my profits are a little bit higher. Like, I guess my argument is, My question is it really inflation? Not so much in the way that people feel it, but the way we respond to it. If we see profits rising in the way that they are, right? I mean, like, productivity should not be going up in the way that it's going up. If it's like, inflation seems to me to be too in price of a term, because inflation can be the things that are causing the rising of prices, or it could be dictating the response to those rising in prices. And those two things are not always the same thing.
No, that's key. And I think unpacking the two gets back to the need to think more broadly about what are the set of the tools and what are the actors that need to be playing a role helping to address the situation. And also, how do we start to think about this, not just in terms of response, but in terms of prevention? So going back to your point earlier about antitrust in this administration, and I'm biased here, I should say my husband's currently in the administration. One of the critical moves they've made is they're not only like, all right, we're going to appoint Lina Khan to head the FTC, but we're going to create a competition policy committee that really says this is something that needs to be embedded in the missions of a much broader set of actors. And I think what we're seeing right now in terms of price stability, and I would also say that we need to think about this in terms of resilience, is the set of tools that are need to be brought to bear, both when things go wrong, but also to prevent things from going this wrong, are much broader.
And what about price controls and maybe nationalizing things? Like, I mean, if a gas refinery, if a refinery will not expand their capacity because they don't want to produce too much gas and then not make the profits that they're making, I mean, like, why can't we say this is a national security issue and you're going to do it? I mean, couldn't we be using the defense, production authorization? Couldn't we be using that more liberally? And couldn't we also be talking about price controls where we're seeing profits grow exponentially and it's supposedly other issues that are causing, these hikes in price?
I would argue that what we actually need to focus on is not trying to come in right now and fully just address these problems at the outer margin with these types of tools, but instead think structurally about what got us to this position. And that's where, again, going back to the rise of the incredibly large middlemen and the supply chains, the middleman economy, as drawn out direct, part of what we see is we created a structure that was inherently fragile. And part of what that means are these boom and bust cycles. And so how do we start to think more long-term and structurally? So I actually think things like, let's onshore certain types of critical capacity. Let's think about industrial policy. Let's think about competition policy. Let's really understand kind of in terms of actual terms, industry by industry, what is the structures that we're dealing with and what are the incentives and problems that flow from that that allow us to try to make the decisions that are going to avoid kind of circumstances like the moment that we're currently in.
Catherine Judge, professor at Columbia Law School, author of Direct, The Rise of the Middleman Economy and the Power of Going to the Source. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. We'll put a link, of course, to your book at majority.fm.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks. Emma just took a...
I'm feeling a little sick. I don't know what's going on right now.
It could be because it's like 150 degrees in here.
Yeah. Well, the good news is there's a flash flood warning outside, so...
Oh, that is good, actually. Maybe it cools things off a little bit.
Hopefully, yeah. I doubt it.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. We're going to have Maddox take a look at Emma. Just a reminder.
The liquid IV.
Exactly. It's your
support. Honestly, I should.
Yes, you should. That's why I got mine right here.
Yeah.
Free, a little free plug for them. It's your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. You know what? Let me just read. I got a couple of emails that I wanted to read just because I want it to be in the free half of the show. Many times on this program, I've asked, why if we could nominate KBJ before Breyer had stepped down, and confirm her.
Right.
Why couldn't we do this before? And
stack them.
And stack them. And we got one answer. I don't know if it's it's one answer. I don't know if it is. But it's from a listener. I'm a law student. I posed Sam's exact question to the law school subreddit a few months ago. Take this response for what it's worth, given the source. But the answer I got was that the judicial commission would no longer be valid if a new president took office because it would not be signed by the sitting president. Now, that seems reasonable to me, but it also suggests to me that, like, why wouldn't Biden right now just nominate somebody else, go through the confirmation while the Democrats still have the Senate, and if, you know, God forbid, one of the right-wing justices do not pass away, then okay, then that nomination doesn't happen. But like Obama, when we controlled the Senate, when there were Democrats who would have voted for a Merrick Garland, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Why not nominate that person before then?
And could the president also, like, thinking through that hypothetical, could, like, let's say Obama stacked a couple, could Biden just sign it even if he lost the Senate? But is like, oh, this already went through that commission. I'm just going to put my signature on that instead of Obama's.
It seems to me, I mean, you could, if it's still hanging there, although I'd imagine once the term of the Senate maybe ends, maybe that also becomes a problem. I'm not sure. But
I mean, they won't even get rid of the parliamentarian, Sam.
Well,
like, not just get rid of the parliamentarian office, which is what I would like. They won't even change the person who's the parliamentarian.
Right. And we know that Bush during in I think it was 2002, or maybe it was even 2001, trying to get rid of they fired the parliamentarian in the Senate to get some Bush tax cuts going. Also, email. The other day, we did a video on a guy named Jason Rantz,
mm-hmm.
R-A-N-T-Z.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, there's no way that dude's, he's a right winger on, he was on Fox. He's a radio guy. And he surprised the Fox viewer by saying, like, well, AOC was right about needing a new, needing a rise in salary for Congress people because, but she's the wrong messenger because
she sucks.
She's a
girl.
An insufferable millennial.
Yeah.
She's a girl. She's actually like
he really a stepped in
example
it.
Of, but nevertheless.
Yeah, somebody who had to work for a living before.
Exactly. And so I speculated that there was no way that was his real name.
It was
whenever you hear anybody in radio, like, my name's Lenny Bruce, not Lenny Bruce, I guess. That would be weird. But my name's Billy Bruce, Bruce Kevin. You know, whenever there's like two first names, they changed their name. And I was like, Jason Rantz, that's just too on the nose. Yesterday, you played a clip of Jason Rantz and speculated it's not his real name. You're right. His real name is Jason Antebi. I went to college with him, where he did a shock jock radio show on our college radio station. My personal connection was that as a freshman, when he was a senior, he used to... I don't know if I should read that. It's an accusation that cannot substantiate. But
we do know his real last name ended in a vowel, which was too ethnic for right-wing radio, probably.
Well, I think he changed it. Maybe he didn't change it then.
Oh.
Anyways... apparently this guy claims that AOL Instant Messenger was used as a conduit between that guy and other freshmen. But anyways, he was a notorious a-hole. That is a statement of
checks
opinion.
Out.
And eventually had his own show taken away from him for harassing students on the show.
Mm.
He then sued the college as a true campus free speech warrior, and they eventually settled. This is from the Inside Higher Ed issue from August 18th, 2006. Jason Antebi, a 2004 Occidental College graduate who hosted a show at the college called Rant and Rave, was kicked off the show shortly after he called two identifiable students' names bearded feminist and douche, respectively, on his show. Antebi, who said he was an outspoken conservative member of the student government, that the students he made fun of had been publicly calling him racist, anti-Semitic, and that he sexually harassed women. And crazy how this is the framework for every conservative aggrievement from campuses to Twitter. Left is best. That is from listener Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. Also, you can get the app at majorityapp.com, and I am the show. But before we do, Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, I did a candidate interview with David Alexis, who formerly started the Drivers Co-op, that app. We talked a little bit about his experience with the Drivers Co-op and his running for state senate in District 21 in New York. We talked for about an hour, 15 minutes, so a nice long interview. I really like, you know, people talk about is doing this work. Is it politics? And David is a guy who was listening to Majority Report and TMBS and Chapo Trap House and then decided to go start that co-op and run for office.
Wow. So sweet.
That makes it a lot more it's nice to hear that sort of thing. So check that interview out. And a think tank for patrons, patreon.com/leftreckoning, where we're over 1,000 patrons, which means I'm going to Austin at some point.
Wow. I saw that.
Yep.
When's the last time you saw David in person?
That's a good question. In person,
have you ever?
I have seen David in person. Yeah.
Is the co-op that he started? Is it the one? Is it the app that I have? The
yep.
co-op.
Oh, yep, it's the that co-op one? App. Yep.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, talked a little bit about that. The sort of
we used to talk about that.
Yes.
Like, why doesn't somebody start one like this?
And they did that. And you know, we talked a little bit about that. Like, you know, there's some truth to that. Like, you can just create an app and it's not actually that difficult to do, although, you know, there's some certain logistical and coding things. But the big thing that Uber has is a whole bunch of venture capital to flood the zone with and to
advertising
and to cover up the fact that they're not profitable.
Exactly. Yeah. You they'll subsidize themselves into a market. So it's worth it for drivers and riders.
We call that the Amazon model.
And then you pull the plug and workers are starting to, pay to notice that sucking sound that the plug's been pulled out.
All right, folks, see you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-5014-57. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
That guy might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way!
Unbelievable.
This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off. No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.